Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. It's a wonderful first day of June 2014. It is good to be with you once again. So let's take a look at what's on tap. Today we're going to talk a little bit about paying respects to Dr. Maya Angelou. It is a very sad occasion for someone of that magnitude to leave us, but she left us with so much. And so I really want to just take a moment to kind of remember her, have a conversation about her, the impact that she has on so many people. And, of course, at the top of the next hour, we will take a look at our Black Acre Policy Forum as we do every week. So we discuss this and much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And now, to help me break all of this down is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises and the author of Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I introduce some and present the others, no other than the wonderful, the magnificent, the great Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, the pleasure is mine. I want to take a moment now to take a look back at Dr. Maya Angelou. Let me begin by asking you, kind of what did she mean to you and kind of what impact did she have on your life?
Well, that's such a loaded question. I remember earlier in the week, on Wednesday, when I learned of her passing. Wednesday was already a truly emotional day for me, as it would have been my brother Don's 50th birthday. So as I was grieving him not being here, then that came across the wire on my phone, and I was actually at Ghost Gym in Missouri to go in for my morning workout, and it just floored me at that moment. I just stopped, and it was though I had lost someone near and dear to me, someone in my family. I mean, she was that person that everybody had a piece of, and she shared herself with everybody. And I personally felt like there were moments when I would hear her speak that those words were directed for me and to me. As I stated to the Reverend Al when I called into the show this week, or tweeted on the show, was that she made me feel as a woman of color. Because of her stature, she made me walk tall because she was tall, and she helped me embrace my tallness. As a girl, I was always taller than everybody, and so for her to talk about it and to talk about her struggles, it empowered me. I often say that my childhood growing up in Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County specifically, that I was always surrounded by women that were powerful. I brag on the fact that I never had a male teacher until I was in the seventh grade, and so I didn't know that women had limits, because I always saw women doing something, and I always saw black women doing something. And whenever there was a play at school or at church, there was about three or four women I was going to be. I was either going to be Sojourner Truth, I was going to be Harriet Tubman, I was going to sing as Mahalia Jackson, or I was going to recite something from Maya Angelou. And reading her book of I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings was just phenomenal. I always say that she and I were kindred spirits, because she was born in Stamp, Arkansas. I spent some time in Stamp, Arkansas, and those that know I was born in Helena, Arkansas. So I always say we were kindred because of our connection to Arkansas. And so for me, it's a loss of someone that I have so much respect for and so much awe, and it's hard to put into words what she's meant to me through the course of my life. There's always a word or a poem or something that I can go back to of something that she stated that would get me through that moment. And it's not always pretty stuff. I mean, Dr. Angelou talked about the darkest parts of who we are as a country and the mistreatment of women, and definitely the mistreatment of women of color. So she was all of that to so many people. And the relationship that she and Oprah has that allowed Oprah to have Dr. Angelou on so many different forms.
Right, read history with.
It has is just, you know, awesome. So you know, I have a lot to say. I have a lot to say. So she's meant a lot to me, and even in watching different tributes and greetings, you know, salute to her, you know, I feel a little tug on my heart, because it's just hard to accept that she's no longer among us in the natural. I mean, her spirit will carry on forever. But the fact that, you know, we have, you know, her words left that she's already spoken, and that, you know, there's not a new gem that's going to come out, but the words that she's given us throughout these years, we'll have to hold on to.
Yeah, this is true. For those that may be just now joining us and not really understand the magnitude of who this person is or didn't know her, I want to kind of take a moment to talk about a little bit of her background, as is read on Wikipedia and as you can find in most historical content. And basically, Maya Angelou was born Marguerite Annie Johnson on April 4th, 1928. and was an American author and poet. She published 7 autobiographies, 3 books of essays, and several books of poetry, and was credited with a list of plays, movies, and television shows spanning more than 50 years. She received dozens of awards and over 30 honorary doctorate degrees. Dr. Angelou is best known for her series of 7 autobiographies, which focus on her childhood and early adult experiences. The first, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which you mentioned earlier, Jima, tells of her life up to the age of 17 and brought her international recognition and acclaim. She became a poet and writer after a series of occupations as a young adult, including fry cook, nightclub dancer. She also did some nighttime work, cast member of the Oprah Best Coordination of Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and journalist. I mean, she's done all, she's been through the fire, if you will. And so that's kind of a little background on who she is. And so she meant so much to so many people, and Jima, you talked about them. I remember her, you know, because of her very distinct characteristics as far as her writing. And one of the writings that I guess I love the most, I guess two of them, which I love the most, is Still I Rise and Phenomenal Woman. And so those two poems, you know, they still stick with me today. And I really like the way that they read. I like the content. I like a lot about them. I'm going to read a little bit of Still I Rise right now. Jimmy, let's talk about her poems. And let's talk about her as a poet for a moment. And Still I Rise goes like this. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? And so that you know, It's an amazing piece of work, and there's other components to it. But, Jima, what do you think about that poem and Phenomenal Woman?
Well, those are the two, of course, that most people recite and remember most, because I think they speak to the core of who we – for me as a black woman, Phenomenal Woman speaks to me as a woman of color, and despite it all, and Still I Rise, a woman of color, and in spite of all that has happened to me, I'm still here, and though you try to do all those things to me, I'm still here. And so it just speaks to our sense of perseverance, our stick-to-itness, that oftentimes we don't know how we're still standing, but we know we are. And those, and that's what resonates with me, I think, and probably many others. To hear those words, it gives you a sense of power in a world that has made you believe you were powerless. It gives you a sense of entitlement to things that you were told you were not entitled to. And so it gives you courage. It gives you, you know, you sit up a little straighter. Your spine is a little stronger. Your shoulders are reared back because you know something greater is coming, because I'm still here. And so you walk into that.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you. No, she recently, I said relatively recently, about a year ago, she had a talk with Oprah Winfrey, and they had a component talking about her age and how she's gracefully aged over the years. Let's take a listen to that, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Take a listen.
Now, as we sit here, you're 85.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, as we are 85. What can you say about the 80s?
Oh, my goodness. Do it if you can.
Do it if you can.
If you have a choice, choose the 80s.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean it. If you've been caring for yourself, you know, moderation in all things.
Yes.
And even moderation in moderation. Don't get too much moderation. You understand?
That's a tweet. Don't even get too much moderation.
Right.
Moderation in moderation.
That's right.
Yes.
But when you get into your 80s and you find that you're still looking kind of all right, and people still say, hello, hello, hello. You think, I'm glad I got this far. Yes.
In the May issue of O Magazine, we talk about aging brilliantly. Tell me what you've learned yourself about the aging point. You know, because I think I learned this from you, and what a wonderful mentor you have been for me for aging with grace and appreciation and heart and just embracing it.
Yes.
And I see so many women around me who even as early as their 40s and some even in their 30s, they're trying to, you know, Botox themselves and, you know, change themselves and fighting it all the way. And I always look at it as, just as you were saying, my God, whatever age, I think about the people who didn't make it.
I know.
As I sit here at 59, I think about all the people who didn't make it to 59. And so were you ever anxious about it? Were you ever, I can't believe I'm turning 40. I can't believe I'm 50.
I can't remember ever being anxious about it, even when I was very young. I mean, I've always wanted to reach that other age.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can remember, I thought that if I could live to be 20,
yes,
you know, it was going to be really wonderful.
And then 25.
And then 30?
Oof.
My goodness, I was just going to, it was a knockout. every age, I've been grateful. I talked to you about this years ago.
Yes.
Is being grateful.
Yes.
Grateful. Just constantly. Get up in the morning. Thank you, Lord.
Yes.
Thank you for this day. Thank you for the light coming through that window. Thank you. Thank you that I'm breathing. Thank you. Thank you for everything. Thank you for the phone call that told me that I have the job. Thank you even for the phone call that told me I'm not wanted anymore. Thank you because I know you have something better for me. Lined
yes,
up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, one of my life seminal moments, I was had the farm in Indiana. You remember the farm?
Yes, I do.
And I was in the bathroom because there were people at the house, and I closed the door, and I was sitting on the toilet seat and on the bathroom phone calling you, and I was crying hysterically about something. I don't remember what it was. And you said, you know, I was calling for your open, empathetic, loving embrace, and you said, stop it.
That's right.
Stop it right now. Okay. I want you to say thank you. And I was saying, but you didn't hear me. You didn't hear what I said. And you said, no, I want to say it. I want to hear you say it. And I went, thank you. What am I saying thank you for? And you said, because you know God has put a rainbow in the clouds.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it,
that was
girl.
Life-changing for me.
Yes, darling. Yes, darling.
So when whatever.
So I want to talk. I mean, so it was just so much in that piece, right, between her, and I just like the fact that how comfortable they are with each other, and you could just tell that there's a relationship there, and that's always, you know, a wonderful thing to have a relationship with somebody of that magnitude. So what is it about Dr. Angelo that commands the attention, and that it, and what is it about her that exudes so much wisdom?
Well, she has transcended race, gender, cultures. I mean, people this week in the civil rights community and in Black America this week spent time talking about her kinship and relationship with Malcolm X and Dr. King, and, you know, the oddity of that, you know, and how she was able to not ever make anyone feel uncomfortable, even when she disagreed with you or was chastising you for your behavior. It was done, you know, out of love. There was no malice intent. And I think that's what it is. You knew when she spoke to you in such a manner that it was coming from a place of love. It was never coming from a place of hate or to hurt you or to demean you or to embarrass you. It was coming from a place of love. And even if she did it in a room full of people, you knew it came from a place of love. And so I think that's what it was. And we can all learn a lot from her and how she mastered the world that she lived in. So many, you know, she touched royalty. You know, she was able to hang with the common folk and yet still walk in the palaces and the mansions and the White House, you know, in the footsteps of Nelson Mandela. And, I mean, she has touched so many lives and been around so many heads of states and from the political side to the social side to entertainment. She just made everyone feel as though they were important.
Yeah.
And there was not a sense of big I and a little you. When you were in her presence, you felt like she was talking to you and that what she had to say was important and you wanted to make sure you got it.
You know, something else in that piece, just kind of piggyback on what you talked about the fact that she transcended culture. And there was no big I or little you, and everything that she did was in love. And so it was interesting that for her, at least for Oprah, to be able to interpret whatever she got from Dr. Angelou through her chastisement or through her corrections or through giving her counsel, that she talked about the rainbow and that through it all there's going to be a rainbow. And I picked up on that because you talked about the rainbow. You mentioned it on your Facebook post about the rainbow a little bit. And so for that connectedness you always talk about, and the one that, you know, I believe that you have, you know, spiritual connectedness that you have with so many people, talk a little bit about the rainbow and in the context of Dr. Angelou, but also in the context of you and how you talk about it in your book.
Well, the thing that the rainbow does is that it's the promise that God made to you that the storm would be over. And so in the cloud, there is the rainbow. And so although it may be hailing and the rain is coming down fast and furious and you can't see an inch in front of you, you have to sometimes look for the rainbow. And in looking for it, you have to press your way through to see it. And so in our lives, we have different types of storms. But when you believe in someone bigger than yourself, which is who God is to me, and she describes him as all, God is all, he is all things. When you believe in something bigger than yourself and you know that in this universe of ours that God has placed things strategically, that even the storm we're in, he is still in control of the storm. I may not be in control of the storm, and I may want to see my rainbow right away, but there's a lesson in the storm that I need to get, and it takes however long he sees fit for it to take for me to be able to enjoy the rainbow when it comes. Because, see, I feel excited when I see a rainbow. I don't know about everybody else, but I get excited when I see a rainbow, even if it wasn't a storm in my life. Yesterday, the rain wasn't that difficult, and things are, you know, on an even keel right now in my world, but I felt the need to capture the rainbow yesterday. And so, you know, I'm excited when I see the rainbow because it tells me that whoever in that storm, whether it was me or someone else, that is passing. And so that's what life is. Life will show you different things, and you'll be placed in different types of storms, and you'll have peaks and you'll have valleys. But the promise that God gave Noah was that when you see the rainbow, then you will know the storm is over. And the thing about it is that there wasn't just one rainbow. I'm even more fascinated when I see a double rainbow. You know, that just like, I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is really awesome. This is great, something great. And I anticipate the rainbow as being a sign that something great is about to happen. I don't know what. It might not even be for me, but I anticipate that the rainbow also says, you know, something greater is on the horizon. So look for it. And that, you know, that's what I do. I look for it.
That's awesome. Well, something is greater on the horizon, and we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to talk about what that greatness is. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Kind of Friends with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, Tailor-Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me. Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So, Jim, I now want to shift a little bit to politics, if you will. Now, there's a story highlighting Bo Bergdahl's parents. Because the parents of Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl want the world to know that they're beyond grateful that their son has been released from Afghanistan after 5 years in captivity. But they say the battle is not over. Now, a report out of CNN says that the recovery and reintegration of Bo Bergdahl is a work in progress. Bob Bergdahl told reporters Sunday in Boise, Idaho, just one day after his son was set free. it isn't over for us in many ways. It's just the beginning for Johnny and I and our family. There is a long process here, he said, referring to his wife, Bo's mother. Jima, what do you think about the activities that led up to his release and the reaction on the right about the success of the release?
Well, first of all, the reaction on the right is pathetic. I mean, I'm not real sure how they sleep at night, and I'm definitely not sure how they wake up in the morning and come on television or send out their tweets or whatever they do. But some of the just straight-out vile, crazy, insensitive, and inaccurate statements that they make. I mean, it's just all of that. So, I mean, having said that, I think the president has proven on more than one occasion that he knows how to walk and chew gum at the same time, especially as it relates to foreign affairs. I mean, we need not go that far back to when the night of the correspondence dinner that he had issued the order to go out and for them to go out and get bin Laden. So, and yet he up there telling jokes and whatnot. And all that. So he has shown himself to be able, as I stated, to walk and chew gum at the same time. And because of that, they cannot accept the fact that, you know, he can handle what needs to be handled. And as he stated, we don't leave anybody behind. And it's been 5 years, and we didn't forget about him. He didn't let everybody know what he was doing, and I guess that's what they're mad about, because he didn't give them a play-by-play of what his plan was. I don't even think they knew he was going in to get him, honestly. So, and I think that's what they really upset about, is that how dare you have this secret mission and this secret. I think that's why it's called a secret mission. I mean, we can't trust the Congress to hold water in a bucket. So, you know, why would he be talking to any of them about secret missions for anything? So, I don't know. But I'm grateful that we have the person in office that we do that cares enough about people of all races, of ages, it doesn't matter, gender, and that speaks to the heart of people and cares and genuinely cares about people. And when he was able to call that family and call that young man's parents and let them know that they had him and that he was safe and he was okay, you know, just reminds me evermore how much I'm going to miss him when he's no longer in office.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is that we really don't know the number of missions that the military that's put on by the president. But we do know that he's had much success when he makes the decision to send them out to go do something. Even if it's not force, it may even be diplomacy, but he's had much success. How much do you think this plays, and you talked about not letting the Congress know because they can't hold water, how much do you think that the 3 a.m. call about the perceived weakness of the Democratic Party when it comes to national defense plays a role in the president's decision not to inform Congress because they always jack things up anyway?
Well, you know, you have to remember the 3 a.m. call was from Hillary about the president. So that was internal conflict, that he hadn't been around long enough to be able to make those types of decisions. And yet, as we've stated on the show numerous times, he's proven himself to be able to handle those types of phone calls, whether it's 3, 2, or 7 o'clock in the evening. So, you know, I think the fact of the matter is that, you know, sometimes we get stuck in one way to do something, and if somebody does something a little different, we don't quite know how to make the adjustment. So because the president is not a brute, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about this a little later, but, you know, he's not reactionary. You know, all of the craziness that was coming out about what he should have done with the VA secretary, and he waited till he got a report, and then he didn't have to fire him. The dude, you know, decided to step down on his own. But everybody, he should have let him go. And same thing they said with Kathleen Sevillis and Health and Human Services back when the website failed. She needs to be fired. And same thing back when stuff happened with Benghazi, and he should have fired Hillary. I mean, it's just, you know, everything about them is reactionary, and yet we have a man that's a thinker, that's a processor, that's going to gather the information and then make the best decision based on the information, not based off of emotion. Because, you know, anybody will tell you that when you make a decision out of emotion, it's probably not always the best decision. There's probably a lot more consequences to it than that. So I think, you know, the fact is, you know, his foreign policy is not their foreign policy. And this week he kind of identified what his, you know, Obama doctrine is, so to speak. I hadn't had a chance to hear the whole speech that he did at the West Point graduation. But so we, you know, we now have something that's a tad bit different, probably more than a tad bit different than what they had termed the Bush Doctrine as it relates to foreign affairs. And I agree with you, you know, when it's time to go in, he's going in. You can best believe he's going. And who's ever in the way might want to move, because it's not going to, he's proven he's not going to not do it. So if you call him his bluff, be ready. And so, you know, that's not his first choice, sometimes not even his second choice. And it is a matter of diplomacy, which lately has become a bad word, you know, to be diplomatic and to sit down and talk about things. That's like, you know, all of a sudden that's to be weak. I don't know where that came from. So I like the fact that he takes his time and when it's time to, you know, for lack of a better word, when it's time to put the button or pull the trigger, it's done. Make the call, he'll make the call.
Yeah. You know,
and so far, every time he's made the call, he's been right.
Yeah, without question. You know, because he sits down, and as you mentioned, he sits down and processes and thinks things through. I mean, he's the ultimate chess player when the rest of the Congress is playing checkers and they're thinking, you know, one jump ahead, when he's thinking, you know, how to castle – how to move his bishop in position, and how to put his rooks in the center aisle. So those are the things that he does real well. And so I want to know, but you mentioned about the Veterans Affairs. So I want to shift there for a second. Now, Washington Post is reporting that Eric Shisecki resigned as the Secretary of Veterans Affairs Friday, apologizing for a scandal in which employees throughout the VA's massive hospital system conspired to hide month-long wait times that veterans faced when seeking care. First of all, my question is to you, what do you make of his resignation? And secondly, will this fix the VA's problem?
Well, he had to resign because there was no other way around it. I mean, somebody had to go, and it's usually the person at the top that has to go. No, the problems at the VA are systemic. They've been going on for 20 years or more. I know people that worked at the VA 20 years ago, and they're talking about these same problems we had 20 years ago. I had people listening in to different radio shows this week and veterans calling in, talking about they got out in the 70s and they got out in the 80s. And, you know, they couldn't be seen. It was a 90-day wait and all these sorts of things. And so for the Congress and media to have this, oh, my gosh, I don't even know what to call it. Like, this is just all brand-new information, and it's just now happening for the first time under this administration is just beyond me. I cannot understand how they think we're going to sit back and let them try to bamboozle us into thinking that this all started under this president.
You know,
now,
I think President Obama has is a lot of transparency, which other presidents didn't have. So the fact that he opens up the White House to the American people to get the information out, I think is a positive asset.
Right, and I think that, but you know, he has to show what he's going to do to fix it though. And so when you're looking at, but, you know, as I stated, I think last week or the week before, I called my doctor in March for a physical, and I can't get in until May. So there's a shortage of doctors or a shortage of people anyway that, you know, that can provide medical services. So if you have the VA and, you know, you have that many positions open, then as a company, if this was a company and I had that many positions open, what would I do as an incentive to hire people? And so that's what they have to do. They have to come up with a way, an incentive to make it worth the value of the doctor that's going to come in and provide the services, the nurse practitioners, the medical staff to come in and provide the services that they need. That, you know, what I heard somebody say that, you know, they need more people that's able to enter the data into a system and that it takes a year to train the people. Well, what system are they using that it's going to take you a year to learn how to do it?
They need to redo the system.
They need to, exactly. You know, what is our government and the VA specifically using? You know, what programming are they using that it takes you that long to understand how to input some information? I'm not understanding that. And so maybe out of this, the investigation will show all those areas of things that need fixing. So it's not just the backlog of patients or the creating a whole other list so it doesn't appear like your list is wrong or whatever. It's not the improprieties and the things that are unethical, but it's going to show the real systemic issues that are happening at the Veterans Administration and how those things have grown substantially a lot since we have an aging population of veterans, those that were, you know, in the Vietnam War. And then we have those that are aging. I mean, your group from the Gulf War, the Iraqi War, the first Gulf War, you know, your age group is aging a little bit. Those guys are coming out and needing, you know, probably a few more services now than they did, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago because you're getting up in age now. I mean, you're mid-40s, things don't quite work like they used to. And then you have, you know, and so then you have the ones that are coming back right now.
Mm-hmm.
With serious brain injuries and loss of limb and injuries that require a lot more. And so if our administration hasn't, you know, didn't forecast, you know, we do this thing called strategic planning. And in strategic planning, you look at the data that you have currently, and then you say, okay, in 5 years we project this. So we've been in a war for 13 years or however many years now. Somebody 10 years ago should have projected the number of people we would be having coming back and what impact that would have on the system, in addition to the number of veterans that were already here that would be needing more services. And so when you talk about, you know, and people say, well, they need more funding, sometimes it's not about more money. It's about using the money you have more efficiently. And so you're already getting $141 billion from the VA, only second to the Department of Defense. And so where is the money going? And I've heard several people call in on shows this week and talk about the money is going to administration and pharmaceutical. It's not going to services. So therein is the first problem. So let's redistribute this. They're getting their bonuses and raises and all this stuff, and how many layers of administration are there? Sometimes we can have too many people, which means nothing gets done, which creates the bureaucracy that everybody talks about in state government and federal government. They always talk about bureaucracy because there's so many layers of stuff. And so maybe, you know, there's somebody that is working on all of this, I'm hopeful, and that they'll see that it's just not an isolated event, which they're already recognizing that the facility in Arizona is just one of 20, you know, that's had some of these types of issues come up. And so I would hope that if they continue to investigate, we really take a hard look at the systemic issues, and I would hope that media would do a better job of not being so reactionary about wanting to get rid of the secretary. That they start, okay, so now he's gone, now what? You still have the same problems was there today that was there yesterday when he was on.
Right.
I mean, so, you know, there has to be another plan. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that they're looking at somebody that knows the language of the military, but that is far enough removed from it where he won't feel or she won't feel the pressure of having to appease the military, Go ahead.
I was just going to say one of the brilliancies of the Affordable Care Act is that the fact that when the soldiers do come home, they will have an option, especially those that may be ETS and are getting out of the service. You know, you mentioned that to do these projections about we was in war for this long in about 10 years, what happens when people come home. And you also mentioned about the aging population, the generation that is aging, as well as you mentioned that several times about the aging population and my generation was in combat. But at any rate, the fact that you do have that in the brain injuries, but the brilliancy of the Affordable Care Act is that when they do return home and they're are getting out of the military, they have options now. You don't necessarily have to be that dependent on the VA hospital system or the VA system, because you can now have affordable access to the civilian system. So when you talk about those projections, once again, I believe the president is looking at the numbers. I think he is doing the projection. And if you was to pull the rug underneath the Affordable Care Act, you're going to have to deal with that as well. So, again, mm-hmm. I think it's a part of the brilliance of the Affordable Care Act.
I agree. And I think, you know, we have to be careful that we don't lump everything all into the same bucket, because, you know, there has been reports that from veterans that once they get the care, it is the best care, but it's getting the care. So therein, you know, is getting to that level where you are then treated and provided for on, you know, for the things that you need most. And so I think, you know, that what you said is true, that is the brilliancy of the president and the Affordable Care Act, that it will open that. And the unfortunate part is, you know, for, you know, them coming out and whether or not they were, you know, what they qualify for, how much they, you know, what their benefits package is, because a lot of them went in under one thing and they come out and that's not necessarily true anymore. But it's you know, the hardest part about anything, and this is kind of interesting because it kind of goes back to something that Dr. Angelou often reiterated, and that was you have to work hard at what it is that you want. And so oftentimes we are a right now nation. And if I have to call two people, I'm mad about that. So I'll just stop at one because one should have been able to do it. Well, one may not. And I might have to call five people. And I don't think I should have to call five. And I maybe shouldn't. But if that's the process, I got to flow with the process until I get what I – because at the end of the day, I need to make sure I'm getting my needs met. It is not the person on the other end's job to make sure I get my needs met. It's my job. And so I may have to push forward and keep calling and keep sending letters and, you know, and keep pressing the system to do what it needs to do. And that's what happened with where we are right now. Somebody was just not okay with a loved one dying. And somebody said, I'm going to keep pressing this until somebody hears what I'm saying. And so we have to make the extra phone call, push the process, follow the rules. And even when you know you've sent them all the paperwork and they send you a letter telling you they're waiting on a piece of paperwork and you can't understand why that is, and you're like, I've given you all I have. You've gotten everything from the other doctor. You've gotten it from the specialist. What more do you need from me? And that's when, you know, you have to say, I've got to keep pressing. I have to keep pressing because this is what's going to make me better. And so, or this is what I'm supposed to have, and so I'm not going to let you not give it to me because of the whatever is going on in your office space. So it's a whole lot to uncover, as you often say, to unpack it. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this him leaving really has no impact on those people still waiting to be seen. None whatsoever.
True statement. All right, it's time to take a look at what's trending. It's time to look at what's trending. All right, here we go. Okay, you got Blackhawks, Lance Stephenson, Bo Bergadahl, Phil Mickelson. And so let's talk about Lance Stephenson. I think that's important. So there's an article in USA Today that says, is Lance Stevenson too temperamental or too valuable for Pacers to lose? Now, quite naturally, this comes on the heels of his antics throughout the Eastern Conference Finals when he was blowing in the ear of LeBron James, when he actually rubbed his face, when he slapped one of Miami Heat's guards, knocked him down off his feet, and his comments, his mannerisms, and so all of this. So the prevailing question after the taunts and terrific play, after the antics and the sideshow, it states that Lance Stevenson in the Eastern Conference Finals, will he be back in an Indiana Pacers uniform? What do you think about that, Gina?
Oh man, I think he'll be back. I think he'll be back, but it'll be conditional, and they might write some things into his contract. And I think wherever he lands, unless it's a team that's just desperate, nobody's going to take him without some conditions. And so he's played himself into that role. And, you know, you always make the argument that everybody needs a crazy person, you know, and you compare Dennis Rodman and how everybody needed Dennis Rodman. And I hear you on that, but I said this the other night at the end of that game, and I'm going to say it now, you know, and I even put it on Facebook the other day that it's in my professional opinion that he needs, you know, some sort of psychological evaluation. And then that night, one of the commentators spoke to there might be some chemical imbalance. So I'm not the only one that is under the vein that something else, you know, might not be quite right, and that we should catch it before he does something crazier than just blowing in somebody's ear and slapping somebody on the head and all this other nonsense he was doing towards the end of the series. And so I think he'll stay there, but he's going to stay there with some conditions. And now that's only if the coach stays. I'm not sure if the coach is going to stay. I'm not sure they're going to bring the coach back. If they don't bring the coach back, you can guarantee that if he comes back with a new coach, there'd be some conditions. So another coach is not going to put up with that nonsense. They don't have to.
Well, I mean, you know, so I'm not real sure if we're just too sensitive these days because there were a lot worse things that happened back in the 80s and 90s when people played basketball. I mean, they were scratching and fighting and pushing and, you know, in the lane getting – you would walk away with blood pretty much every game, especially during the playoffs. And so, I mean, are we just so sensitive these days, and we take, you know, what typical play in the NBA, do we just take it out of context sometimes?
Okay, so those are two separate issues, in my opinion. On the one hand, yes, I think we have become a little soft when it comes to our sports in terms of, you can barely, in football, you can't even touch a quarterback and you're getting a penalty. So, you know, it's a contact sport. Somebody's going to get touched here at some point. The same thing in basketball, you know, it's the heart, it's defense is what's supposed to win games and win championships, and yet, you know, you playing tight on somebody, and or you up in their face, or you elbowing and moving things around a little bit, then you call for a check and you get suspended and you get fined. You got all these. So I agree with that. But I think that's a separate issue from the antics of Stevenson, because those antics wasn't just playing defense. That was something a little bit different than even what they did back in the day. And we know people talk trash. I don't have a problem with you talking trash, because we know back in the day, Charles Barkley's of the world and Daryl Dawkins them, you know, I'm going back on you. You know, Chocolate Thunder, they were some trash talking folk. Karl Malone them, you know. But they backed it up, though. See, you can't be talking trash and then you don't show up for a game.
Right.
You know, that's the difference. And so therein lies some of his issues. As well. And so I just think, right, on the one hand, yes, we have gotten a little softer in how we play the sport. But on the other hand, I still think he has some mental health issues that need to be addressed. Because as did Dennis Rodman all those years, and nobody ever talked about it, we just kind of let him go. Like, oh, that's just Dennis Rodman, you know. And then here we are 10 years, 15 years out of the league, and and he now wants to admit he has a drinking problem. Well, you probably had a drinking problem 20 years ago. But because it was just Dennis, nobody, you know, we didn't question it. The dressing up in the prom dress, the wedding gown, and the wigs, and the makeup. And I mean, you know, all of that.
Dennis was over the top.
And, you know, and then the football player dude that stopped playing because he just wanted to go get high. Ricky, whatever his name was, that went to the University of Texas. They just wanted to go get high, so he just quit playing football. What's that all about? You know, and so those sorts. So we have signs what's happening in these people's lives, but because they're entertaining, and it definitely takes us out of our own whatever life we have, we'll just go along with it. But we're living in some dangerous times, and people now take out everybody in the room, or everybody on the street, or everybody in their house unnecessarily. And so I just don't want Lance to end up in that type of situation.
Right. What about Terrell Owens? Wasn't he on Fix My Life?
Yes.
Do you think he had some of the same mental challenges as well?
Yes. Well, you go back to when he tried to kill himself, allegedly, and he overdosed on some pills accidentally. I mean, that right there was his initial cry. But nobody heard it because he was too caught up that he's frail. Why he need to try to kill himself? He got all this going on. But when you look at his life, you know, here's a young man growing up in the neighborhood and didn't know his own father stayed across the street and had no relationship with him and had a whole other family. And so you carrying that into your adulthood, and I'm expecting you to be an adult. You're not, and to act a certain way. And your whole life is about making the people around you love you because you feel so unloved because you didn't get it from the one person you thought you needed it from. And so your whole life is an antic to be seen, to be heard, to be revered. I mean, because everybody remembers running to the middle of the star when he played for San Francisco. Everybody remembers that when they was playing Dallas. Everybody remembers, you know, the antics and the eating the popcorn and the junk. I mean, everybody remembers pulling out the Sharpie because so we remembered all of that. And yet when we look at him now, we're trying to figure out, well, how did he fall? He was already falling. But because he was on a team making touchdowns, the landing was soft. Well, he doesn't have that now. And so he's like, I don't have any other skills. I never learned how to do anything else.
Right,
then you
right.
got this 40-some-year-old man who has nothing, doesn't have anything to offer the world because the only thing he thought he had was football. And now that that's been taken away from him, he doesn't think he has anything else to give. So how do you think his story is going to end if nobody checks in with him fairly quickly? How's his story going to end?
Yeah. Speaking of stories and endings, is this the end of Phil Mickelson? The fact that there's a wide range of insider trading probes right now that he's included in. And so there's a report right now on Money, CNN.com, that states the probes involve stock trades made in 2011 after ICANN made an investment in Clorox, according to the sources who are not authorized to speak publicly about the case. ICANN bought shares in Clorox and later announced taking over bid for the company, causing shares to rise significantly. Prior to the takeover bid, there was suspicious trading in Clorox shares, and both Mickelson and Walters have bought shares in Clorox. So what do you think is going to happen to Phil Mickelson now that he's into this and they're probing or investigating this stock scandal?
Well, I hope that they do not try to cover it up. And he, you know, the consequences need to be as hard on him as they were on Tiger in terms of sponsors and all that stuff that he lost, money that he lost just on the fact that he was cheating on him. He wasn't, I mean, it ain't against the law to cheat. I mean, that's not a law. I mean, it's a moral law. But, you can't come arrest me for cheating. And so here this man has been investigated for something that's a criminal act. I just hope that they're swift I hope public opinion is just as swift on him as it was on Tiger. But, of course, what's going to happen is going to be, oh, let's wait and see what they come up with before we decide what to do. And then I'm going to be angry when that happens. Because it's all, you know, they get the luxury of the wait and see. We don't get the luxury of the wait and see.
Well, you know, they made Tiger come out and they do press conferences. They followed this dude around. I mean, it was crazy how they was treating him. And, again, he did not break any laws. And but Phil Mickelson allegedly is involved in something that could be really land him some jail time. And this story is trending on the web, but I haven't seen a lot of it really being talked about in the mainstream media. Now, when you turn your news on, you know, you'd be hard pressed not to hear a Benghazi story. You'd be hard pressed to hear. To not hear anybody talk about Bengal, the guy that was rescued from Afghanistan. You'd be hard-pressed not to hear people talk about the VA story or the VA scandal, because those are things that are in the news. And so, you know, Mickelson is of the same type of stature as a Tiger Woods. And so I'm not sure why I'm not hearing the same effort in investigating him and all of the. It was breaking news when it came to Tiger Woods. I mean, they was cutting off shows, and you know they was cutting, you know, just like they would do the president when he is giving a speech. So it's interesting to see, but I'm going to make sure that you know more people are aware of this investigation, because I want them to, you're right, they should get the same treatment. Regardless of who they are, if they're going to treat one guy a certain way, they should treat the other guy the same way.
I agree.
All right, that's our trending topic. It's time for us to take another break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gina, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Gemma. And Ask Gemma says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And, of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says Bergdahl's safety and health were both in jeopardy and that officials had to act quickly to obtain his release. How long he will stay at the Landstuhl Medical Center is not known. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Berlin.
Meanwhile, celebration in Idaho today on word of Bergdahl's release. His family held a press conference in Boise this afternoon where his father, Bob, said they haven't called him yet because they know he will need a lot of time to heal and decompress from his ordeal. The father also says he's not sure if his son can understand him.
I hope that when you hear this and when you're ready to hear this and when you see this, I hope your English is coming back. And I want you to know that I love you. I'm proud of you. I'm so proud of your character.
Bergdahl's release and the transfer of five high-level prisoners from Guantanamo in exchange has critics saying it was a dangerous decision. Republicans also say Congress should have been informed of the plan 30 days in advance under U.S. law. Louis Katz, the co-owner of the Philadelphia Inquirer and former owner of the New Jersey Nets, was killed in a fiery plane crash outside Boston yesterday. Dave Davies of member station WHYY in Philadelphia reports the cause of that crash isn't known and there were no survivors.
The 72-year-old Katz was one of seven who died when the plane caught fire and exploded during takeoff on a runway at Hanscom Field near Bedford, Massachusetts. The cause of the crash is under investigation. Katz made his fortune from parking garages and billboards and later became majority owner of the New Jersey Nets and Devils. Katz bought a share of the company that owns the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News in 2012 and has for months been embroiled in a bitter battle with other investors for control of the enterprise. He died just days after his faction won control of the papers in a court-ordered auction. Katz's son, Drew, will take his place in the management of the company. For NPR News, I'm Dave Davies in Philadelphia.
Roger Federer is out at the French Open. The number four seed and 17-time Grand Slam winner was ousted in five sets by Ernest Gulbis of Latvia. That loss ends Federer's nine-year streak of making it to the quarterfinals at the French Open. This is NPR. Mount Rainier National Park officials say there are no plans to try to recover the bodies of six climbers thought to have fallen more than 3,000 feet to their deaths. A park spokeswoman says it's too dangerous for search crews. A helicopter spotted camping gear in an avalanche-prone area. The climbers were last heard from Wednesday night, and they were supposed to have come down from the mountain Thursday morning, but they didn't show up. Officials say they heard the avalanche warning pinging from the climbers' gear. Police in India say three suspects have confessed to the gang rape and murder of two young girls who were found hanging outside their village in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. From New Delhi, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports the case has renewed outrage 18 months after the notorious fatal gang rape of a young woman on a bus in Delhi.
The senior superintendent of police in the area, Atul Saxena, said the three suspects were all from the same family. He speculated that the two girls had been killed to prevent them from identifying their assailants. The girls had disappeared last Tuesday night after going out to use a field as a bathroom. Like hundreds of millions of Indians, the two cousins had no toilet at home. Authorities have also arrested a pair of police constables on charges of conniving with the criminals and failing to respond to the family's pleas to search for the girls, who relatives say were aged 12 and 14. The father of the youngest victim blamed a dominant caste in the area. The crime is rapidly taking on political overtones, and a national investigation is expected to be announced this week. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, New Delhi.
It's the first day of the 2014 hurricane season, and forecasters are trying out some new technology to track the storms. They'll be dropping small drones into the storms, trying to learn how they get stronger. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, we're at the top of the hour in one of my favorite segments of the hour, which is the Black Acre Policy Forum. This is, of course, a blog that was posted by one of the friends of the show, Leo Baron Hicks. Now, you can go out to his blog, and that's at blackacrepolicyforum.org. And that's B-L-A-C-K-A-C-R-E, Policy Forum, all one word, blackacrepolicyforum.org. Today, called A Tale of Three Cities. Now it reads, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going to direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisy authorities insisted on it being received for good or evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. This is the opening line from another brilliant piece of writing, this time Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. The novel, which is set in both London and Paris, depicts the lives of the French peasantry and aristocracy during the French Revolution, while noting the similarities between French society then and Victorian England of the mid-1800s. Over the centuries, A Tale of Two Cities has lost none of its potency. The narrative of social and economic injustice and the dangers thereof apply not only to Paris and London, but to Washington, D.C. of 2014 or any other modern city. Like the French and English, American income and wealth inequality has never been so obscene. And while we are bereft of nobility, we are full of, literally dripping with our own aristocracy in the form of the uber-rich, political dynasties, corporate royalty, and the gods of sports and entertainment. Consider, for example, the salaries of American CEOs versus that of the average American worker. The median pay package for the leader of a large company just passed the $10 million mark. A chief executive now makes about 257 times the average worker's salary, up sharply from 181 times in 2009. There are some who might argue that the salaries of corporate titans are well-earned, that the wealthy are the risk-takers, the job creators, and are therefore deserving of the best. They further contend that any talk of income or wealth inequality is nothing more than class warfare, thinly disguised. Blackacre takes exception to this notion. Corporate CEOs are hardly 250 times more deserving of than the rest of us. They are not 250 times more intelligent than average worker or no more loyal, hardworking, or productive than anyone else. They are not hundreds of times more patriotic than regular people. They do not tithe at 250 times the rate of other churchgoers and do not love their mothers 257 times more than you or I. Moreover, wealth affords those who possess it the luxury of avoiding, mitigating, and or covering their risk. It is we, the average Joe or Jane, who are the real risk takers. Akin to the peasants of France and the denizens of England, we peril the freedom of poverty and need our entire risk-filled existence. We risk work-related injury and death in the factories and coal mines of America. We hazard working at jobs that abuse us, pay slave wages, and lack insurance coverage, disability benefits, or retirement plans. We gamble that we will not be arbitrarily or unjustly fired, that our positions will not be replaced by soulless automations. We bet the farm that public funds will be used to create long-term, well-paying jobs that will not disappear overseas. We chance that the roads, infrastructure, and tax credits given to the corporate America will not be negated by corporate raiders who bleed bone dry otherwise viable companies. We wager that oil spills and fracking would not damage an environment already teetering on the edge of radical change. We wager that corporate accountants will not cook the books, that hedge fund managers will properly manage their funds, and that the banks that are too big to fail will not in fact fail. We then fervently pray that avaricious financial wizards will not crash our economy and walk away scot-free while we modern-day Gaspars struggle to pick up the pieces. Furthermore, this disparity in wealth and income has nothing to do with merit. CEOs are paid 257 times more than the American worker, not because they deserve or have earned it, but because of payments in stocks, peer pressure, the superstar effect, friendly boards, and in an ironic twist, stricter scrutiny. According to a 2005 article by Benjamin Hermelin, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, when a company is in duress and or a CEO faces a greater chance of dismissal, companies often raise pay to compensate for the risk of job loss. Accounting scandals of the early 2000s showed that some executives actually gamed the system, ultimately at shareholder expense. Executives at firms such as Tyco and Enron tinkered with the books to boost corporate income, share prices, and fortunes of insiders and senior managers. Even when they fail and fail miserably, CEOs are still rewarded with multi-million dollar golden parachutes. The low wages of the American worker is similarly undeserved. Workers are paid 250 times less than CEOs for reasons other than their contribution to the bottom line, i.e. automation in the form of robots and computers, high unemployment, which shift the balance of power to the employer, globalization, weaker unions, and low inflation. Nor are the wealthy true job creators political slogans to the contrary. Jobs are created by the demand for goods and services, which is fueled by a solid middle class. Businesses are made possible and profitable in substantial part by public contributions in the form of business incentives, infrastructure development, tax benefits, and favorable public policy. The real explanation for income and wealth disparity in America and the world at large is simply this. The fifth is in. The economic, political, and legal systems are rigged, slanted in favor of the wealthy against the poor, skewed to benefit the haves at the expense of the have-nots. This is the reason bankers and Wall Street executives were not held personally and criminally responsible for the 2007 financial collapse. Why the best way to rob a bank is to own one. This is why a well-known sibling of a wealthy music duo has not been charged with battery and domestic violence, even though her crime was videotaped and disseminated to the world. Public policy and the law have always treated the rich and famous more kindly than others. Sadly, Black Acre has no solution to the rigged nature of society. We do not suggest the engagement of the guillotine known as the French razor. We loathe the type of violence practiced by the Jacobins during the Reign of Terror. And since the tale of political, economic, and social inequality has been told and retold since the dawn of man, there may be, well, no long-term solution. But at the very least, we can take the false and misleading statements of politicians, vulture capitalists, and other snake oil salesmen with the amount of salt they deserve. If calling out the fixed system of social and economic injustice constitute class warfare, then so be it. Leo Baron Hicks, founder and CEO, Black Acre Policy Forum. Leo, welcome to the show.
So much, Mr. Cook. How are you?
Oh, man, it is a pleasure to have you with us once again.
So, my brother.
Another great piece of work. So give us a little insight on what made you write this blog this week.
Hey, man, look, when I saw that corporate executives make 257 times more than you and I, that just blew me away.
Yeah, that will do it.
I mean, my God, 257 times more than you and I. And let me tell you, Mr. Cook, I've dealt with some corporate executives and some of the high and mighty, and I got to tell you, they ain't all that.
I have to agree with you. So what is it then about our system that allows this to happen?
Well, again, man, I just think that the system is rigged. I mean, one of the reasons I introduced a piece with The Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens is to show that since the dawn of man, this kind of wealth and income inequality has always been with us, that the system has always been rigged. And I'll tell you, Mr. Cook, I love beautiful writing like the introduction to A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yes, yes, indeed. I definitely have to agree with you. So speaking of good pieces of writing, the Bible has been quoted as a good piece of writing, and the Bible says there will always be poor people. So does this come as a surprise that we have this disparity?
No, it doesn't, but I think what's troubling is the fact that it is growing, and that it is growing exponentially from 181 times to 257 times in the span of a few years. It's troubling, don't you think?
It is, but isn't the solution to say it's time for everybody to get rich?
I think it is. I think we should go all in and become unapologetic capitalists. Absolutely.
So at what expense, though? So, I say that jokingly to say that because I don't believe that we all have the capacity to be entrepreneurs or the capacity to be millionaires, billionaires, because, I mean, it's not only just making the money, but you also got to understand how to keep the money. So, but at what expense if we was to go all out and to be and to really take on this sense of capitalism, would that cost us anything?
Well, there are certainly a lot of things that I won't do to be a millionaire. I won't pimp. I won't be a pimp. You know what I mean? I could not live with myself for engaging in that kind of vicious business for my own pecuniary gain. So there are some definite things that I draw the line at that I simply will not do to make money. But I think the important part is this. While the Bible is certainly correct that the rich will always be with us and the poor will always be with us, A Tale of Two Cities is cautionary. Because it clearly shows that when the income inequality gets too far out of whack, there are some real social and political implications that you have to deal with. And if you read about the French Revolution, you'll know that once the peasants revolted, it was nothing pretty. I mean, they engaged in a reign of terror that lasted for years. So we do have to be careful to have some type of balance between the wealthy and the poor. And my concern is that we are moving to a point of insustainability, that we can't sustain this kind of income and wealth inequality.
So you know, I tend to agree with you, especially when you keep having laws go into the favor of the rich, meaning that you have this thing called affluenza. When a rich person go out and commit a crime and get a spank on the hand, and a poor person go out and conduct the same crime and get life in prison, or you have the disparities of drugs, and you know you get caught with an ounce of this in one neighborhood, you know you get community service, but you get caught with it in another neighborhood, you get life in prison. You know, and so, and I can go on and on about the disparities, and so, but what does it take? What will, how long, or what's the tolerance level of the American people to say, enough is enough, right? Because this has been happening, and as you mentioned, it's growing exponentially. What is the point and we're going to say enough is enough?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you in France, during the French Revolution, it reached a tipping point where all hell broke loose, where the peasants stormed the French palace at Versailles. I think I'm pronouncing it wrong, but you know what I mean, where they stormed the palace, where they took the king, where they beheaded him. Weeks later, they took Marie Antoinette, beheaded her, mm-hmm. and for years, there was just social disorder where thousands of people in France died at the guillotine. Now, again, I don't know when it's going to reach that point here in America, but I can tell you this, that if you don't have equality, eventually what you have is a contempt for the law. And you mentioned, or maybe I mentioned, the case of Jay-Z and his sister, his sister-in-law. That's a perfect example of the unequal scales of justice. Now, if you and I did that, and our guilt was caught on tape, we'd be looking at a criminal charge.
Yeah.
Maybe some jail time. But because of them and their notoriety, doesn't it amaze you that nothing happened?
Yeah. So, Jima, let me get you to weigh in here on the blog posts and specifically about the inequality. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Leo. I think we're at a point now. The sad part about it is that I don't think people realize how bad off it is. They see the numbers, but I don't even think people know where they fall at in those numbers. And I think people, when you talk about the amount of money that corporate people and CEOs are making, for some strange reason, we've convinced ourselves that they know something that we don't, and that's not true, and that they're so more deserving. And yet, and even in your entry, Leo, you talked about because they're considered to be the job creators, but they haven't created any jobs lately. And so you would think that we would, as you say, storm the place because of the amount of just the sheer numbers of those that are still unemployed, because those that could create the jobs are not. You would think that we would storm those buildings, those offices, and demand, and yet when we do stand up for something like, let's say, what we've been talking about in terms of minimum wage, and increasing that, the spin that is placed on it from a media standpoint, you know, you would think that people would be wrong for asking for more money, so they can live, you know, to have a livable wage, so to speak. And so I just think we're so disconnected from reality, from our own reality, that we don't really know how bad off we really are. And it goes back to even how bad things really were under the previous administration. We didn't really know. Either we didn't know, we didn't want to know, we didn't want to pay attention. And then it was like all of a sudden it was like, bam, we've been losing millions of jobs a month. And it's like nobody was telling us that we were losing millions of jobs a month. Either they were telling us and we didn't believe them, or they wasn't telling us. And so here we sit now with the same kind of disbelief, like, oh, the income gap can't be that wide. And yet we're seeing that it is that wide. And then we keep making excuses as to why it's okay. And it's not. So I don't know if we will ever storm the city, so to speak, as they did in France, but something needs to happen. Or, you know, it can only get worse. And although Scripture speaks of, you know, there being poor among us, it also speaks of being your brother's keeper, and it also speaks of taking care of the least of these. And so, you know, we have to, if we're going to, you know, live by the word and quote it, not you two, I'm talking about in general, not y'all. I know y'all get it. Then we got to do the whole thing and not just pick out the parts that make us feel good.
So I wonder then, you know, going back, revisiting the point about let's all get rich, then that sounds like that's the plan then, Leo. What do you think?
Well, I think it is. Again, man, I think that we as a people should go all in unabashedly, unashamedly, unapologetically to capitalism. We should be entrepreneurs. I mean, you can't complain about not winning if you're not willing to play the game. So we definitely have to play the game, but even that game is rigged. Things simply are not fair. They're not designed for us to win. And I'll tell you, man, the point that Jima made is the point about incredulity. If I got $2 million, you won't have to worry about me anymore. I'm going to be fine. I'm not going to bother you anymore. I'm moving to a gated community, changing my phone number. I'm good, right? I can make it. I'm quitting my job. I'm changing my name. I'm straight. But some of these corporate leaders, man, make money that is beyond belief, that I can't even wrap my head around how much money they make. And I have to repeat, I have dealt with corporate leaders. I have seen politicians. And I tell you, some of them are just idiots. Some of them are not smart at all. They're just positioned.
So what is it about them, though, that allowed them to be in that position? I mean, they have to have something that enables them to at least get to rise to that height. I mean, so what separates that person from a person like me when I put in work and spent the long hours? What separates them?
You know, I don't know if I can answer that question with specificity. I can tell you two things that come to mind. One is positioning. The people in power position certain people to rise to the top. Let me give you an example. I think Beyonce was beautifully positioned by her father to be a success. I think Venus Williams and Serena Williams also benefited from positioning. The people they loved made sure they had the resources and the connections to be successful. Sometimes, though, Mr. Cook, it's just dumb luck. When I look at some of the money these rappers are making, in spite of the fact that the musical ability is minimal, yet they came in at the right time and jumped on the bandwagon, the only thing I can do is shake my head and say, it's got to be luck.
Okay. I mean, I can see that. I mean, it's definitely some luck going on around in a lot of places. So I wondered then, the CEOs have, the system is rigged, basically. If the system is rigged, so, I mean, does that mean that I shouldn't get in the game if it's rigged?
I mean, that's a good question. Look, if you buy stocks, for example, the profit is already taken by the fund managers before you even buy the stock.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? The cream is already taken off the top.
Right.
Before you even put your money down and buy the stock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so that is a good question. And the question is, if you play the game, are you enabling a corrupt game? And that is a legitimate question. At the very least, though, this is the bottom line for me. I really don't want to hear a bunch of nonsense about certain people deserve to make 257 times more than I do because
right.
They're the wealth creators.
Right. That's nonsense.
Police.
Yeah.
Absolute nonsense.
I have to agree with you on that. All right, so any final thoughts, Leo?
Nothing, but I just appreciate you. I think you have a great show.
Oh, man, the pleasure is always mine. You know, again, I want you all out there listening to us to go out and visit Black Acre Policy Forum. Again, it's Black Acre Policy Forum. It's BLACKACRE. Policy Forum, Black Acre Policy Forum, all one word, .org, and check out what Leo's doing. He's doing wonderful, great things. Leo, thank you for coming with us again.
You're so welcome. And one last thing before I go. I'm waiting for your guest contribution.
All right.
You know, I'm waiting for you to write some up.
All right. I heard you, man. All right. I got you.
Okay, dude.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. It's time to take a quick break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and my dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, Tailor Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, Tailor Made's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to move to a new segment that we're going to do here, the Black Enterprise segment, and I'm going to talk a little bit about money and finance. So, in particular, I want to talk about this new article that's going on Black Enterprise right now. And it has to do with the Justice Department initiating a consumer fraud investigation by the name of Operation Choke Point. So let's take a moment to take a look at this article. So the Department of Justice had criminal probes for four payment processors, one bank, and several officials as a last November. Now, this, of course, is being reported on Black Enterprise and by Reuters. And U.S. prosecutors have begun criminal and civil probes into roughly 15 banks and payment processes over the past 12 months. Furthermore, a memo from a Department of Justice official says the department has separate investigations focused on roughly 10 banks and payment processes under civil fraud law. Now, the goal of the investigation is to tackle fraud by zeroing in on firms that manage and transport money with businesses that seem suspicious. The initiative is named Operation Choke Point because through sifting through those who provide financial services to specific industries, the government can choke off the cash needed for these industries to survive. The inability to process payments will cause the businesses to be unable to survive. Jima, you know, this is a Leo's blog was a timely blog because I wanted to introduce this new Black Enterprise segment to talk about just money in general, because I think we need to now bring financial issues to the forefront, because in a lot of cases I hear you know, people talk about the system but very seldom get involved in the system, you know, create a product, engage in the blood, sweat, and tears it came to make that product, you know, something special. So I wanted to kind of start talking about this, and what better way to do it through Black Enterprise. So first of all, what do you think about this injustice and cutting off these banks?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it seems once again, you hear stuff after it's already happening, and you're trying to figure out how did we get here, and so that's just I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
You know, the fact that, you know, the Department of Justice is giving it a name, you know, they call it Operation Choke Point, and the fact that they're not necessarily going after them in a way that will kind of just kind of put them off, they're kind of going them so they can just cut their money, cut their bloodline. So it kind of goes to Leo's point about the system and how it being rigged, and the fact that they can, you know, continue to survive and continue to do that. It also goes to the point where we talked about yesterday at dinner when my father was here, and just saying that, you know, the fact that, you know, there's a price point, right? There's a company will say, it will cost me $10 billion to do this thing, and I can make $10 billion. If I got caught, then it would only cost me $1 million. Well, I'm not going to change my behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the two examples we talked about was, you know, GM and the cars, and the other example being Vanessa Williams and the fact that you know, releasing those photos when the magazine did. So mm-hmm. it seems like, you know, this is continues to be the case with respect to companies being able to do that and just sucking it up because they make so much money.
Yeah, I mean, and like you said, it kind of speaks to, you know, what we were talking about yesterday, and like you were saying that, you know, if I can cheat, for, you know, air quotes, and get away with it, and I've made all of this money, and by the time you find out about it, I've made hand over fist, so whatever fine you decide to give me or impose upon me, you're not going to completely bankrupt me, so it's not going to matter. I've already made more than what I need anyway. So go ahead on and you know, levy your penalty against me. But as a business, I'm still going to be fine because I already have the money. You're not going to take the money away. That's what these days, you take the money away. But they only take a percentage of it or a piece of it or you know, a little bit. And but they could go, there's a way they can go back and prove, you know, like they do with drug dealers or people that do money laundering. They seize all your assets and you can't do nothing. You know, you don't have access to any of the money because they're trying to figure out whether or not that money was made illegally. Well, why can't they do that with banks? You know, or, you know, these corporations, why can't they limit their access to stuff?
Right.
You can
right,
only
right.
use what you need, you know what I mean, to run your business. But all the extra fluff, we're going to put a freeze on that. You know, that would be something to catch somebody's attention and make them want to do right.
Yeah, I mean, and the policies that are different for people than for businesses is also perplexing. I mean, especially when it comes to borrowing money, right? So a bank can go out and borrow money at 0% interest, and then loan the same money to me for 7% interest. I think, oh man, that's wonderful! I got 7% interest. Really, when at the bank, all he did was a pass through. And they made 7% off of it. A pass-through. So, I mean, nothing had to happen. And, in fact, me, as the worker, is the person that go out and actually loaning myself the own money. Here's what I mean by that. I go out and I work a 40-hour-a-week job, right? Let's say I make $400 that week if I'm making $10 an hour, right? A percentage of that goes to pay taxes, right? Which means the government takes that off the top. So my labor has provided funds to the government along with millions of other people. I go to the bank and say, hey, I need a loan to purchase a house. Then the bank goes out and get the money from the government, which I and other millions of other people has worked for, and take that money and give it to the bank. Now that money that I worked hard for, that they've taken from me as taxes, now given to the bank, and then the bank loaned back to me at 7% interest. So I'm now working for the money that I'm also paying interest on it and taxes on it, my labor. That's a crazy system that we're in. And I think, and when I see a business getting by like this, it is you know, very perplexing to me.
Yeah, I agree.
So you know, I want to continue to keep issues like this in the forefront, because I think when we focus on education, quite naturally, that is something that we go after, right? When we focus on the political system, we become a part of the. Go out to vote, and we participate in the political process. When we, attend rallies, when we're in the jury stands, when we're going out and being for or against an issue, I think that's important. But I also think important because we're in a capitalist society that we really become more intimate with our money. We really understand what's happening, and we begin to respect our money. And so that's why I want to start making this a major part of the show, because it definitely is something that we all need to be paying close attention to. So that's my 2 cents on that. I want to move now to something else in the news, and that's the Arsenio Hall show is leaving us. Jimmy, after several seasons, and I was really getting to enjoy Arsenio Hall and all the wonderful things he was doing, and I saw the Cat Williams interview, and I saw a couple other things that he was doing as of late. And I thought, as Arsenio Hall does, he does a really good job of getting to the core and allowing people to open up, you know. So why do you think they canceled his show?
You know, that's the biggest unanswered question, because earlier in the year they had said that it would be renewed, that it had been renewed for a second season. And so there's even, rumor mill online, in terms of even people at CBS, the different affiliates, did not know that it was not coming back. So I'm thinking this caught a lot of people by surprise. And, I'm not really sure why, because, it was in a hard time slot in terms of the timing. It came on at 10 here locally, which is right at the top of the hour for news time, and then the second hour would go up against all the other 10:30 shows. But it was relevant to me because, as someone stated, you got to see people that look like you, that had, that you were interested in what they were doing. But it was a variety of people. I mean, even, although everybody on there wasn't black all the time, there were people on there that I liked to see and hear what they were doing and what movies they were working on and things of that nature. So it's kind of unfortunate, but, I think he'll land on his feet. If not, on OWN, he may end up on TBS or somewhere else, some other cable network. But I think it's unfortunate because he did bring something back to late night that had been missing for our generation of people. And so that's unfortunate, but I'm pretty sure he'll land on his feet.
Yeah, that kind of brings us full circle back to something that Dr. Maya Angelou said about when you lose a job in one area, you tell the person thank you because you got something much better coming around the corner. So I think
right.
That's also true for our senior, because he is good, right? I mean, he is a talented, unapologetic, and he's been in the game for a while, and he had it all back. I mean, he was really starting to hit full stride, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And so
exactly.
When you have that type of talent, I mean, it is just a moment of time before, someone picks him up or he starts his own. I'm a big proponent of stop asking people for stuff, right? Going out and doing it on our own. If we really want something bad enough, let's go do it. You don't have to ask. And so it may be a little challenging to go out there and create the space for you to do that, but that's exactly what you have to do. You have to create that space. And And so I think that's exactly what he will be able to do. And the fact that we do have an own now, and we do have, you know, several shows that are catering to people of color and our culture and our views and our laugh, you know, our jokes and our comedy and all the things that we do. So I think there's definitely a place for him to land. So let's talk a little bit about sports. Donald Sterling suing the NBA. What is wrong with him? Did we know
that
was coming?
There has been a report released that there is two separate doctors that are stating that he is not mentally capable of making decisions, which is a clause in their trust agreement that if either he or the wife becomes mentally incapacitated, then the other one would take control. So since he's the one that is deemed now to be mentally unfit, she now has control of the trust, which means she can now sell the team. So all of that is working itself out, and I think that the league was too quick to cancel the meeting for this week where the owners would have had to vote it whether or not to ban him from the league. I think they should have taken that vote, whether he owned the team or not, because now you give him an opportunity to try to come back in. You know, I mean, he's 80-some years old, so I doubt that he would. But I don't think the family should have their way back into the league anytime soon. There should be some sort of stipulation put on that as well. So, but I think he's, you know, this is what he does. He doesn't take anything laying down. So, I mean, every suit that's been brought against him, he's fought it. And some of them he's won because he had the money to fight. So I'm not surprised that he's fighting it.
So that just go. I mean, again, it goes to this, you know, what we've been talking about all day. I mean, basically about the money. I mean, it does separate you. And so that's why important, it's really important that you have it.
Mm-hmm.
And not spend it and not do all mm-hmm. these things with it. You need to be in a position so you can you know, do things with it. And these people get away. And I mentioned this a couple of shows ago that they were going to put spin on it. I said it. I'm going to play the tape when I get it. How I gonna, you know, they're going to make it about something else. You know, it won't be about race when it's all said and done. It'll be about his mental capacity, or it'll be about the female, or it'll be about his wife, or it'll be about the way in which the attorneys play the game, or it'll be about the NBA. But at the end of the day, it won't be about Donald Sterling. And I hold to that statement, and it's going to prove to be correct at the end of the day. All right, we're approaching our final several minutes before the end of the show. And I guess the other thing in sports that I want to talk about is that the finals are set, right? We have a repeat. The San Antonio Spurs will be playing the Miami Heat in the 2014 NBA Finals. Who's your pick?
I'm not sure. I think I'm going to go with Miami. I don't want to because everybody's going to go with Miami, but I've never been a fan of San Antonio because, I mean, I like them as a team and great, whatever, blah, blah, deep in the heart of Texas and everything. But, you know, my heart is, you know, with the style of play of Miami. And so I'll pick Miami in six.
I know that was painful. All right, give us your final thoughts.
Well, my final thoughts are several. One, just in case anyone hasn't heard, right now we just found out that Alice that played on the Brady Bunch, you remember the maid Alice?
Yes.
From the Brady Bunch? She
yes.
just passed away today at 88 years of age. She was she had a fall in her bathroom on yesterday, and she never regained conscious. So old Alice from the Brady Bunch dies today at the age of 88. And that just came across the wire. I think as we go back to the beginning of the show, my final thoughts, you know, one of my other favorite poems, my mom bought me the complete collected poems of Maya Angelou back in December of 1998. And so I have at that time, all of her poems that she had written, I have them all in one complete collection. And one of my favorites, of course, outside the one that everybody always talk about, another one of my favorites was Our Grandmothers, and another one was the one that she had entitled The Caged Bird. And in The Caged Bird, she talks about that the caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown, but long for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. And so when you think about why the bird, the caged bird sings, you think the caged bird sings because it has, because that's what birds do. And so even in the midst of all you have going on, you have to find your way out. And it's because you know you're not supposed to be caged up that you continue to press on towards something else, and you continue to look for the rainbow. And the one poem that you know brought me my greatest sense of connectedness, probably for the first time, to this place we call the United States of America, is when she did the poem at President Clinton's inauguration on the Pulse of Morning. That poem resonated with me in such a way that it touched me deeper than who I was as a woman, who I was as a person of color. It touched me probably to my core of who I was as an American. And to have her on those steps on that cold morning recite that was just phenomenal in itself. And so that's another one that speaks to me often. On the Pulse of Morning, her poem she did at the inauguration, and so it's just awesome. And so that's what I leave you with, is to go and review that one, because the rock still cries out to us today, and that we are a river that sings a beautiful song, and it says to come rest here by my side. So she is now found her resting place. She is now at that seat at the table that she has often spoken about, sharing the meal with all of those who have gone on before us. And her life was so full, and she saw so many things and felt so many things for so many people. And so just as we leave, just remember that you want to know that you're leaving behind a legacy. And what will your legacy say about you when your time on this side is over? And I just pray that I've touched somebody's life on this journey, and that my living has not and will not be in vain. So I am looking forward to the rainbow. I'm looking forward to what's on the other side of the storm. I'm looking forward to things that are due, that are coming my way. I anticipate greatness. I'm looking forward to it. I'm embracing it. As I stated on my page, you know, my eyes and my heart and my mind and my arms are wide open to the possibilities and the opportunities that are coming my way, and I'm so excited about it. And I just pray that as I embrace these things that are coming my way, that you can get on and ride along with me and enjoy the ride, you know. But if you don't want to go, that's fine. I'm going anyway. There's a church song, an old song that says, I'll go if I have to go by myself. And that's
right.
Kind of where I am right now. So yes, I'm excited.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent, Jima Hill Cook. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE, talkradio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to current events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of George Spencer in the title track, Lion's Den. Sweet dreams. Take us away, George.